This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Welcome back, everybody, to Milkshakes Markets Madness. My name is John Kutzmita. This is Brent Johnson. This is a show, not a podcast. This is a show where we talk about financial markets. That's the market piece in the name. The madness, well, it feels like every day we're living in a world of madness, particularly in the financial markets, and especially true in Twitter, where we're engaging with a lot of people about the financial markets. And the Milkshakes piece about our name, you can find more about that on our website at milkshakespod.com. It's part of the Dollar Milkshake Theory, a clever little narrative that Brent came up with. We won't talk about that here. You'll have to do your own research. But speaking of milkshakes, markets, and madness, Brent, here we are, episode 10 of season one, and we decided to push back the recording an extra day so that we could see what was going to happen with non-farm payroll. And within that 24 hours, a lot more has unraveled. Is there anything that you want to reflect on at the end of the week here before we start diving into some of the events?
Well, you know, today's actually a really interesting day for a couple of reasons, which I know we're going to get into a couple of them. But, you know, when we were texting yesterday, I made the comment that I thought that, you know, we would have a beat on new farm payrolls and the markets would sell off. And we're kind of at that place now, but it's been a weird day because while there was a beat on the non-farm payrolls, unemployment ticked up a little bit and hourly wages came in a little soft. And so that was seen as dovish. And we saw, you know, at least in the pre-market, markets took that as a dovish sign, because just a couple of days ago when Chairman Powell of the Fed was testifying before Congress, he said, you know, we have a number of data points coming up for the next week, and those are going to be very important in helping determine, you know, whether we raise 25 basis points or 50 basis points. So to see somewhat dovish data come in, everybody kind of jumped on that as a dovish sign. Risk assets kind of took off. But that was combating the news that kind of broke yesterday that, you know, a very large bank in the United States, Silicon Valley Bank, was in trouble. And, you know, it was down significantly, and there was a run on the bank. And so, you know, by the time markets opened, you know, some of that contagion, for lack of a better way of saying it, was starting to spill into the markets, and you know, equities and risk assets had kind of come back down. And they've kind of been bouncing around all day. I think they're down right now, but the market's still open for another few minutes, so we'll see where it ends up. But the other interesting thing is today is kind of the first day in a long time where we've had any kind of contagion fears, like where something could grow into something much bigger. And what's really interesting is that U.S. Treasuries have been rallying over the last 48 hours on this news. And, you know, for the last, let's call it year, Treasuries falling in price as yields rose in the face of inflation was the cause of the volatility, was the cause of equities selling off. So this is the first time in a while that we've seen, you know, Treasuries rallying kind of on a safe haven bid. And it's just kind of interesting because, you know, over the last year, as Treasuries have fallen so much, people have said Treasuries are no longer a safe haven bid. Today, when we get a little bit of risk off and a potential contagion, we got Treasuries rallying. So it's a very interesting time. It's a very interesting day. It certainly wasn't a boring day. And we'll see what happens with it next week.
Yeah. So one of the things that we also have talked about a lot off air is the kind of the reaction mechanism of both markets and just people who are engaged in the conversation around markets is they're bouncing all over the place. There's not a real like grounded mentality about how they're approaching either their investments or at least investment conversations. There's a lot of ideology, you know, people are very, very deeply rooted in their bias. And so you start to see these kind of, you know, volatility spikes in these types of moments because no one's winning. And, you know, you coined the phrase a couple episodes ago, violently sideways. And all this, though, if this feels like we're kind of turning a corner and maybe it's risk off and bonds are going to be a bid again. I mean, number one, when you have a move this big, I mean, this was the largest move in the 2 year since Lehman. So 2008, yep. It's very unlikely that this trend continues on Monday. And not to say that this trend doesn't continue over the next couple of weeks, but you know, when you have these big moves, there's usually some sort of rebalancing, but I feel like people's emotions don't rebalance with the market. And so we are kind of seeing this, this continually play out over and over and every week when you have the volatility where no one can really say, see, I told you so, except for maybe a day or two. You know, one of the things that, you know, we've been pushing in the last couple episodes, and again, we've talked about recently off air, is people need to kind of let go of their belief system and stop chasing things that are going to reinforce their bias.
Yeah. And, you know, what I think is kind of interesting is a lot of times people will say, yeah, central bankers have influence and, you know, government officials have influence, but the markets are bigger than the governments and markets are bigger than regulators. And ultimately, the markets are going to win. And first of all, I completely 100% agree with this. And a lot of times I will hear that with regard to gold. Okay, so gold's down now, but in the long term, gold is absolutely going to go higher, right? And so, you know, over the last year, the Treasury has been raising rates. They've wanted asset prices lower. They've actually wanted bond prices lower. I don't care what you think about the Fed. They're not so stupid that they don't understand if you raise rates, the bond prices fall. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to engineer a slowing economy. They want to engineer a slowing economy in order to fight inflation. One of the ways you engineer a slowing economy is you contract the collateral off of which new money can be created. And that means bond prices go lower. But yet today, bond prices went higher, a lot higher. So even though the you know the regulators and the Fed wanted prices lower, they got bond prices higher today. So that, you know, my point is this, you know, markets winning doesn't just relate to the Fed. I mean, it doesn't just relate to the gold market. You know, there's a lot of other assets that kind of have the same thing going. And, you know, ultimately the markets are going to play out. And it's, to me, what's really interesting is over the last couple of years, every time we've had any kind of a risk-off event, it hasn't lasted for very long. And it didn't cause any contagion. And even last year, as you know, equity prices went down a lot. There was never like a big contagion. It never felt completely out of control. You know, the Fed kept hiking rates regardless of markets going down. So what's really interesting to me now is to see whether this event, this Silicon Valley Bank event, will lead to any kind of contagion. Because you know, for the last year or so, it hasn't. And I think to your point, I think it's very easy to see the headline and say, yes, this is it. This is means the banking system is going to collapse next week, right? Now, I'm going to say, maybe it will. I can't say for sure that it won't. And I understand all the dynamics that could lead to that happening. But it wouldn't shock me at all to walk in on Monday morning and see, you know, markets are up 1%. And maybe they do something over the weekend that changes the mood and everything's fine for another month or another 6 months or whatever it is. So, this is a long way of saying to, you know, pay attention, understand the headlines that you're seeing, but don't necessarily jump from one headline to the other.
So when you're going into an event like the non-farm payroll, and this was a pretty important one when you really consider what was going on in terms of the inflation data, there wasn't a clear, a lot of emphasis was on NFP this week. Like, is this going to be the thing that tells us what's really, really happening? And, you know, you get a nice beat on the job numbers, but the things that potentially mattered at inflation were, you know, sour. You know, you had a reasonable uptick in unemployment, 3.4 to 3.6. It doesn't seem like a lot, but in terms of what we look for in a non-farm payroll report, it's a big move. And then, you know, wages softening, so you're not having that wage growth, which means you end up kind of moving more to like a stagflation environment because prices are high, but you know, the economy's not keeping up with it. So it mattered a lot this morning. How do you go into something like that? Like, you know, you sent me a text saying, hey, this is kind of what I think is going on. Is that just conversational? Yeah. Or are you taking positions around where you think this is going to be? Or do you feel like you're already positioned going into it and you're just kind of watching the fireworks?
Well, so for the most part, I'm already positioned for it. I mean, you know that I have very long-term positions, and I do, when I see a really good opportunity, I'll do a tactical trade. But I'm not, you know, turning over my entire portfolio, you know, on a regular basis. That's pretty rare for me to make a huge change. But what I will do is when I'll do some small trades around. So as an example, if people have heard me say this all year, you know, I am long equities, I'm long risk assets, but I think because of the type of environment that we're in and because I think we're going to have a correction, I have hedges on. Well, over the last 3 or 4 days, as the VIX was below 20, and as we were moving towards Friday, and I thought that we were going to have a good jobs number, which meant I thought that the Fed would stay the course and continue to hike, I thought that, you know, most likely we'd get a risk off move. And so I had added, so I, Wednesday and yesterday, when the VIX was at like 19 or 19 and a half, or it might have even got down into the 18s at one point, I'd added to those puts a little bit. And, you know, over the last 48 hours, those paid off pretty well. And so today I was selling some of them. You know, I made some money on the hedges. I sold some of them. I still have some of the hedges. But that's how I kind of go around that. If I see an opportunity, I'll do a small trade, but I don't do huge trades all the time just based on what I think a headline's going to be.
So what is your take at this point, just for conversation's sake? I know you're not really moving your portfolio around it, but how do you see the non-farm payroll? Do you think that's just kind of another bit of noise in this choppy sideways pattern of data and markets, or is this kind of the turning point?
No, I expect the Fed to continue to hike. I think they'll hike at least 25 basis points. You know, we'll have to see if the last couple of days continue in the next week, and if we get a soft inflation print next week, then I would expect the Fed to only do 25 basis points and maybe even signal that that's it. But if next week turns out to be okay, if inflation comes in a little hotter than expected, you know, then they're going to do at least 25, and maybe they do 50 basis points. My overall viewpoint hasn't really changed. Again, a headline doesn't really change my whole viewpoint. I'd have to give a number of headlines or a number of data points that would make me do that, or something would have to change fundamentally that I either change my mind on or I see something new. I haven't really seen anything new. You know, all year I've been expecting, I thought we'd get a run at the very beginning of the year. It went a little longer, a little higher than I thought it would, but over the last 4 to 6 weeks, the market's kind of been playing out how I thought it would. I think Q2, Q3 is going to be pretty tough. I think the easy money's already been made this year. I think the rest of the year is going to be very difficult. So I think the rest of the year is mainly about protecting capital as opposed to making a bunch.
Look, let's talk about banks, because this is, an interesting week, as we said. So you've had a couple banks close down. The first one that got attention was Silvergate, and they were more involved in crypto. And not really a huge bank per se, but it was definitely something that caught the market's attention, and maybe was that the canary in the coal mine to start out. But really, the Silicon Valley Bank is interesting because it was rather large. I don't know if one would say it has a contagion risk by failing, but it does. Hopefully, it makes people question the you know, the solvency of where they bank, because generally from a loan to value, like risk management perspective, it wasn't, you know, they didn't blow up because of, you know, bad assets. They really blow up because of bad hedging. And what's interesting about our banking sector is you have these regulatory components that a lot of people don't necessarily understand, which is why you see things go on in the bond markets like they do. But this bank, you know, maybe made some bad decisions, but they made bad decisions technically in good assets that just lost value because of when they bought. So they were buying bonds. And do you think some of that is because of this regulatory environment? Maybe they were in a position to rebalance and they just bought at the wrong time. Now all of a sudden they own these assets that are significantly down if you mark to market, but banks are also allowed, in addition to printing money, which we talked about last week and as far as credit growth, but in addition to printing money, they can kind of, you know, do this hold to maturity balance sheet shenanigans, and not necessarily shenanigans. I mean, it's just, you're not marking those assets to market, so it doesn't look like they're carrying this big loss. But then somebody whispers in the movie theater that there's a fire, and all of a sudden everyone's running for the exits. And so a relatively, in the modern day banking system, a relatively healthy bank suddenly has a run on the bank, and less than 48 hours later, they're in receivership.
Yeah, so you've hit the nail right on the head. And I think, and the really interesting about what you're talking about is it's so all-encompassing. So I'm going to try to explain this in very simple terms, but it really goes back to everything that's happened over the last 2 or 3 years, or you could even argue over the last 15 years. But essentially, let's just use the last 2 years as an example. Everybody knows what happened with COVID. You know, businesses were shut down. You know, people worked from home. The economy wasn't moving. And so the government sent out checks and, you know, did stimulus and, you know, tried to plug that hole from the economy itself not functioning. And in that environment, you know, it was very hard for people to go out and hire. It was very hard for people to borrow money and start a new business. And so the banks, at least over the last year, this has started to change. But, you know, let's call it from 2020 to 2021, even into 2022, there wasn't a lot of demand for loans. So what do, in that environment, you know, when a bank has deposits, what do they do with that money? If they're not loaning it out, they go buy a bond with it, right? Well, over that same time period, these, and for regulatory purposes, like you mentioned, they have to hold certain types of collateral, often which entail being government bonds or longer-term treasuries or medium-term treasuries. And those have the lowest risk weighting. And so those are the ones they buy. But they're doing that when interest rates are very low. And the reason interest rates are very low is the Fed is holding them low, doing QE, trying to stimulate the economy. Okay. So that's the environment around which banks are buying bonds, low-yielding bonds, and putting them on their balance sheet. That works really well until 2022, about a year ago. Now the Fed starts to hike rates. And most people, including most banks, were kind of skeptical about their ability to do it. Even though at every meeting and every couple weeks for a year, Powell came out and said, we are hiking rates, it's our number one concern, getting inflation down. I don't know if people just didn't believe them or if they didn't quite appreciate the risk or what it was, but over the last year, rates have gone from 50 basis points to 450 basis points. Now, on a 1 or 2 year bond, that's not such a big deal. On a 10-year bond or a 30-year bond, that's a big deal. That means that those bond prices are down anywhere from 15 to 30%, depending on the duration and the type and the, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so the assets of the bank are dropping in that environment. But to the point that you just made, nobody really knows the assets of the bank are dropping. They kind of theoretically probably think that they are, but it doesn't show up on their financial statements because the banks aren't planning to sell those bonds. They're going to hold them to maturity. If they were marking them to market, if they were marking them at liquidation value and posting their balance sheet every day on their website, then you would say, holy cow, this bank is losing money, or this bank is not in good shape. But because they don't do that, because they don't have to do it, because they can market to maturity rather than market to market, everything looks fine. And in reality, everything is fine until there's a catalyst, right? Whatever the catalyst is, and it might not even be a big catalyst. It's the proverbial, you know, straw that breaks the camel's back. One person decides to go get their money, and somebody else decides to withdraw their money. Somebody else decides to withdraw their money. And pretty soon they've withdrawn enough money that the bank has used the liquid cash to pay back the depositors. Now they have to start liquidating assets to pay back depositors. But in the meantime, those bonds that are marked to market are actually getting sold. Or I'm sorry, those bonds that are getting marked to maturity, 100 cents on the dollar or 99 cents on the dollar, whatever it is, are now getting liquidated at current market value, which is 75 cents on the dollar or 83 cents on the dollar. And all of a sudden those losses start to show up. And as the losses start to show up, more people start to think, hey, maybe I should get my money out. And it becomes the classic bank run, right? Now, you can say that Silicon Valley Bank should not have been buying treasuries. That was such a stupid bet. You know, obviously with interest rates at 5,000 years old, there's only one way this could go. Well, it's easy to say that unless you're a bank, because banks can't go private equity. You know, you don't want your bank investing in the stock market. There are limited things that the bank could do. And from a regulatory standpoint, they have to buy bonds or they have to buy certain types of securities. Now, what they could have done and what they probably should have done is hedge that interest rate risk better. You know, that's one thing that they could have done better. And maybe they didn't have to go out so far on the yield curve, but The point is all of this stuff is related. It's not due to just one thing. Part of it's government mandated, part of it's market dynamics, part of it is where we are in the overall cycle of not just the short-term cyclical cycle, but the long-term global cycle. You know, and everything kind of starts to hit, and like I said, the straw that breaks the camel's back causes a bank run. And so that's what's happened with Silicon Valley Bank over the last, really just the last week, right? And it's amazing how quick it can happen once it starts. The point I would make is that Silicon Valley Bank is not the only bank that this applies to. This applies to many banks, right? A lot of banks were doing the same thing as Silicon Valley Bank. Now, will it become a contagion where the whole banking system comes into crisis? That is possible. Of course that's possible. That's part of my thesis, right? Is that we were at the end of this long-term debt cycle. At some point, the piper's going to have to get paid. Does that mean it's going to happen next week? I don't know. And I'm the first to say I don't know. And neither do you. And the person reading or listening to this, you don't know either. So don't go all in on the idea that the market is going to completely melt down next week. You should be ready for it. I'm not saying don't be prepared. But I don't think that you see this headline on Silicon Valley Bank and all of a sudden you put all of your money on the banking system collapsing within 2 weeks. That's probably not the right way to go about it, but you should definitely understand it. And then the other thing I would say is, what's interesting to me is that, and I know I'm kind of rambling on this, but you probably could tell I feel kind of passionately about it, was that everybody is very happy, at least that I see, very happy to glob onto this that's happening in the U.S. because I feel like there's the zeitgeist is that the U.S. deserves it. It's finally coming home to roost. The chickens are finally coming home. And the one thing I would say is everything that's happening to the U.S. To these U.S. banks, it's happening because interest rates were very low. They bought very low-yielding bonds, and now interest rates are higher. Okay, fine. It's absolutely something to be concerned about. But what I don't hear a lot of people talking about is that for the last 10 years, Europe and Japan have not been buying low-yielding bonds. They've been buying negative-yielding bonds, which makes it even worse. And so when interest rates rise in Europe and Japan, which they will eventually, whether that's, again, if it's next week or next year, I don't know. But the point is when those interest rates start to rise, it will be even a bigger issue for them than it is for U.S. banks, because we were not buying negative yielding bonds and because we didn't have negative yielding bonds in the U.S. And this is part of the reason why I say that the rest of the world is in worse shape than the U.S. It's not to absolve the sins of the U.S. We've committed many fiscal sins. We're going to pay for them. Silicon Valley Bank paid for them over the last 48 hours. But just because we are sinners doesn't make the rest of the world saints. And you got to be very careful about, you know, seeking out the headlines that validate your theory and totally ignoring the headlines that you don't want to talk about because it doesn't.
Yeah, and one of the things that you mentioned before is on that soapbox is when you have a bias or there's an ideology that you... it makes sense to you, and then you wrap your entire universe around that, and that becomes your reality. Then you find somebody who's really good at articulating that view or that emotion that you're feeling. And a lot of people in the financial space are, as you put it, this is a Brent Johnson quote, they're too eager to make the big call, right? So everyone wants to go out there and make this really bold statement, and they get likes and retweets and all of this, you know, reaffirmation that they're on the right track because it's a good story, but there's all these other underlying things. And to your point here, like, is this thing with Silicon Valley the beginning of a run on the banks and the end of the real estate market and all these things that I think people are praying for because they've missed every bull market for the past 4 years or decade because they fell in love with a narrative, someone who's eager to make these big calls, and they were the wrong calls. So it's such an important time right now as these things are pulling at each other and we really don't know the direction, to have an open mind and dig deeper into ideas or opinions that are very, very different from yours, because it could ultimately save your ass. And one of the things that's interesting about a bank failure and a run on a bank and all these types of things, and I'll pass it off to you, is that ultimately ends up meaning in various forms, credit contraction or the disappearance of deposits. And therefore, ultimately, that's going to lead to even stronger or higher demand for dollars.
I know, exactly right. And one thing I would say is, you know, with regard to the being eager to make the big call, I'm not saying that analysts or portfolio managers or gurus have. I don't mind people making the big call. I don't really have so much of a problem with the call itself, because I kind of like it when people will make a call as opposed to being wishy-washy. Mm. The biggest problem I have with it is when the retail public or the inexperienced investors glom onto that call and apply 100% probability to it. And so my point is, when you see a headline that kind of confirms your bias, that's great. That means there's evidence that your thesis is working. It doesn't mean you should go all in on it, right? That's two separate things. And I feel like we're so much in this, you know, we've talked about this before, this quick hit, all or nothing, you're in and you're out, and it's all one. There's no nuance left, right? And so I think I love it when people, like, when they listen to podcasts and when they send me articles. You know, I on Twitter a lot, people will send me articles, they'll post a podcast, they'll say, hey, did you hear this? I actually love it, because I, you know, there's sometimes I miss things, and they'll show me things that I wasn't aware of. Or, you know, and if they have a question that I can answer, I'm always happy to help people answer the question or answer a question for somebody. But what I hate is when I see the same person over and over and over just sending me something that confirms their bias, or perhaps it goes against me. They think they're going to hurt me because they can post a headline that goes against my thesis, and that's going to, like, ruin my day or something. I always kind of find that kind of funny. But my point is I think it's great to do the research. I encourage everybody to do their research. I encourage everybody to think about things critically. Just don't glob onto one thing and make that 100% of your portfolio. And perhaps nobody's doing that, but my fear is that I feel like people are doing that. And so that's what I'm always cautiously against.
Yeah, well,
I can actually give you a good, I can give you a perfect example of that. You know, this happened this week. I've been fairly outspoken that I think that when we get into this, you know, sovereign debt crisis or global economic crisis or whatever kind of, you know, chaos that develops over the next few years, I think the U.S. is going to perform better than a lot of people I talk to think that we're going to. And so, you know, every time the BRICS countries or the emerging markets have done even anything slightly positive, I get the articles sent to me and I see blog posts and I see, you know, Twitter tweets saying, you know, this is a further proof that the U.S. is finished and the rise of the BRICS. And so I saw an article yesterday or 2 days ago, I can't remember, and it was talking about how Saudi Arabia, which is one of the BRICS countries, the supposedly Saudi Arabia is going to join the BRICS, was now working with the United States and Israel, you know, on a potential security deal. And I retweeted it, and I knew exactly what was going to happen. It was almost bait. It was like I was fishing, right? I just threw it out there. I'm like, I wonder how long it's going to take. Well, it took about 30 seconds, and people were already sent back saying, oh, if you really believe this, then you're just, you don't know what you're talking about. Oh, of course, the Wall Street Journal, like they know what they're talking about. And the point that I was making was that, and it was, it allowed me to make it perfect, but it was because if that headline would have said, you know, Saudi Arabia and China have partnered up on a whatever deal, people would have absolutely agreed to it, right? But when it goes against what they think, it's going to say, well, then I'm just going to ignore it. And the reality, though, is, and then there was another headline that came out that was kind of said the opposite. And neither article really had that much info in it, right? There wasn't a lot of deep dive revealing information on either headline. And so, but one headline was immediately gravitated towards and the other one was immediately dismissed. And that's the wrong way to do it. If that's the way you're conducting your analysis, I hate to tell you, it's going to end up really bad. So try as hard as you can to remove your bias, read each headline, and read the article. You know, I'm not saying not to read them, but just don't accept everything you read as fact. And hold your own headline that you like to as much critical thinking as the headline you don't like.
Look, I think that's such an important statement to make and really, really clarify. And it's one of the things, although we have certain viewpoints or perspectives on the show, I think we're also trying to encourage people to just kind of stick our opinion into the equation. It's not the opinion. Yeah. It's part of the analysis. You know, I was in my late 20s in the GFC and, you know, I was kind of a surfer dude in Hawaii. I was in finance a little bit. I was a young guy working at a mortgage company. Didn't really know what I was doing. It's just sales at that point. And watching this whole thing unfold in real time, particularly some of the, like the trials and guys like Blankfein and just the arrogance that they had as like the financial system's imploding, it really makes you scratch your head and be like, wait, what is really going on here? And that's how I started my Twitter journey. And I do feel like back then Twitter was way more of a Mensa. Like you could formulate a timeline and really learn a whole lot of things from people that were trying to achieve the same thing, have a conversation. And now it feels way more like dogmatic attacks on each other. But one of the biggest takeaways that I had over that, I'd say that next like 5 to 10 years, is you had these really, really profound narratives, guys like Schiff that I really appreciated back then, and article sources like the Zero Hedges. And it taught me a lot. It also, at the time, based on what I understood and knew, made a lot of sense. So I fell in love with it. But also slowly over that cycle, realizing where there's aspects of what they're saying that were true, but it didn't actually pan out. And the timing of things can be much more different. And I appreciated and learned over that time that the best thing that you can do is not fall in love or hold on to an ideology and realize that you really don't know what tomorrow's outcome is going to be. And the more inputs that you can absorb, the more likely than anything else, like you've said before, that you get to avoid that huge drawdown or, you know, hopping onto an idea that ends up wiping you out. And so that's been a big part of my own personal journey. And so I think, you know, when we have these dialogues, and certainly you're the milkshake theory guy, and so people think that that's, you know, you're going to die on that hill. And it's more how you position at this point thesis and trades around this potential outcome. And it's interesting because one of the big things right now is every time we go through these interest rate cycles, and again, I think people are just so angry that they feel left out of the party because they did what in their mind was the right thing. Like, well, I didn't buy real estate because it was a bubble, or I didn't buy the stock market because it was a bubble, or I kept my money in savings because that's the prudent thing to do. And so everyone's sitting around waiting for the end of the world. And now we have 40-year high inflation. And so the next thing is, this is the end of the bond bull market and inflation's here forever. And so one of the things I was thinking about recently, I'm going to get your thought on before we wrap up here, is, okay, let's say inflation, like you had mentioned before, let's say the Fed, you know, silently or quietly or without really telling anybody has already raised their inflation benchmark. Maybe it's not 2% anymore. Maybe it's 3, maybe it's 4. Right. So we're in a hotter than usual inflation environment, and technology maybe pulls down on that a little bit, but it feels like with the labor market's doing, that could very realistically be where inflation is the next couple of years. But then we look at a place like Japan, you know, for 30 years they've done, or not that long, but for quite some time they've done yield curve control. And so just because inflation sucks and is really, really a systemic issue doesn't necessarily mean that something directly correlated to like the bond market is suddenly just going to suffer these catastrophic losses for the next 10 years as well. So it's I don't know if you want to lean in on that, but it's just one of those things. As a mortgage guy, I'm looking at interest rates and I feel like, is this really the end of the bond market when you're looking at demographics and the fact that our central bank's going to stand aside and let banks like Silicon Valley Bank and even bigger banks blow up because they've gone on this rapid interest rate hiking cycle and they're killing the value of their balance sheets?
Well, I think the only thing I would add here is, again, just to clarify, like, we're not saying not to look for the canary, right? You want to, the canary in the coal mine, that can be an extremely important thing. The point, though, is that if just because the canary in the coal mine dies doesn't mean you're going to die the next minute. Maybe it's an indicator that you're going to die in the next 5 years, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen right away. And it kind of goes back to the all or nothing, right? Just because the canary in the coal mine dies doesn't mean you need to go put on the, you know, the widowmaker trade and put all your capital into it. You know, you can use the canary just as one data point. It doesn't have to become the end all and be all data point. And I think as we move forward in time, that we're going to get more of these data points. And I'm a believer that volatility is going to increase, not decrease, right? But I don't have 100% of my portfolio on volatility calls. I mean, that to me, that would be silly to do. These big, big moves, they can happen really quickly, but the overall impact typically takes, you know, months, if not years, to kind of fully play out. I've said this many times, that I think that this whole, you know, sovereign debt crisis, fourth turning, however you want to describe this whole, you know, event that we are going to have, I think, or, you know, in the future, I don't think it's going to happen over 6 months. I think it's going to happen over 6 years. I think there's going to be fits and starts along the way. But I don't think we're going to have some big event and a year from now we're going to be on the other side of it and everything's going to be rosy. That doesn't seem likely to me.
You know, it's getting fun now for us because this is episode 10 of season one. We kind of were getting warmed up at the end of last year and we did what we called season zero. We did 5 episodes. So we now have a bit of a library forming. And as you're talking about this, I'm already thinking back to previous episodes that I think people should check out. One of those is very early on, like second or third. I think it was called Milkshakers and Widowmakers. We talked about Japan and because you said the Widowmaker trade and we talk about how people like Kyle Bass have a very strong, a great way of articulating this approach, but his ability to balance out the trade so he doesn't get hurt is often something that, you know, people miss out on. And then I think one right after that we did was Hedge Fund Storytellers and The Art of the Narrative. And again, in line with this, like, milkshake theory is, it's so important for people in your position to take these complex ideas, water it down, and give it in a way like it's dinner time conversation. And the better you can get at that, like you did with the milkshake theory, the more you help people understand your view on the market instead of a bunch of charts and jargon. But don't get lost in it as if that's this like hyperbolic one-way trade. It's really just a clever way of describing a viewpoint. So yeah, so I encourage people to go check out those other episodes. We'll put that in the show notes. Brent, it was a wild week. I think this was a really fun episode as far as getting a little deeper into some of these topics and trying to cool people down when you have all this volatility. It's going to be fun to see what happens next week. It could be calm seas. You know, the storm could have just blew through really quick, or hey, man, this could be a hurricane that sticks around. Any last thoughts?
No, I think the only thing I'd say is, you know, John and I started this because we were doing this anyway. We were doing this anyway, and we just decided we're going to film it. And we've been having fun with it. I hope the audience has been having fun with it. We always talk about what we want to talk about, but if anybody has an idea that they specifically want us to talk about, please, you know, email us or message us. I can't promise you we'll get to it, but we will try. And, you know, we're open to your ideas on topics, so don't be shy to make them known. Even if they're bad ones, or even if he wants to tell about all our mistakes or John's dating life or whatever it is,
we'll get to that in a future episode. So our latest episode, as we're recording this one, was talking about avalanches. So again, we use, you know, analogies to kind of paint this picture, and the engagement's been great. It's been a busy week for us both, but the comments have been awesome. We're going to get to those before we post this one, but the engagement's really appreciated, and the feedback and the conversation that people are starting to have both on YouTube and Twitter. So definitely keep that up. We appreciate it. And again, topically, if there's something that you want us to discuss, we do read it. We do say, hey, we got to talk about this, but then the market gets so crazy and here we are going way over our 30 minute mark. We do plan on actually doing more of a conversation series where we're going to have guests on. It won't be this scheduled show, but it will be in line with Milkshakes Markets Madness. But, I think it's time that, you know, we bring somebody else into the fold and have a nice long form, discussion. So people should stay tuned for that. Otherwise you can find Brent Johnson on Twitter at Santiago AU Fund. You can find me at John Kutzmita. This is Milkshakes Markets Madness. You can find us online at milkshakespod.com. And the handle for YouTube and Twitter is the same, Milkshakes Pod. We appreciate you joining us, and we can't wait to see you next week. Thank you, Brent. See you soon, man.
See you, everybody.